What's up? You're listening to Soft Difference, a podcast of Redeemer Presbyterian Church, Winston-Salem, North Carolina. On this pod, you'll hear from Giorgio, Eric, and myself, Justin, talk about 1 Peter and how 1 Peter calls us to love Jesus and love others in the world. All right, welcome back, party people. I'm Justin. I'm here with Giorgio. Giorgio delivered the message on Sunday, and so we're excited to talk about 1 Peter 3, 8 through 17.
Got it.
This passage G is like one of, I think, one of my favorite passages in the Bible. It's just the, growing up as a Baptist and witnessing being a big part of our DNA,
right?
There was a format for witnessing that did not look like this.
It didn't include all the humility and it,
well,
tender.
Well, I mean, I don't want to be deriding that too much,
right.
But it didn't include you being questioned. Hmm. It included you as the what is the word?
Inquisitor.
and you asking questions like, if you died an IG,
yeah.
And you have to stand before God, what will you say? And so I remember always like being intimidated by that reality. And this passage, and also like in my little anxious heart, would often think about, man, I'm not doing enough. And do I really love Jesus if I'm not willing to do this?
Right.
And I remember at some point reading this passage in 1 Peter and going, now, this is a different like way of evangelism,
right?
Where you're actually being questioned,
right?
To give a reason for the hope that you have, that your life is the witness, and it invites questions. So I wanted to start there,
okay.
And I wanted us to think about the people listening that individually before we think about this like broad y'all communally. Mm-hmm. What would you say based on preaching this text to someone like me who often thinks of evangelism this way? And this is an evangelistic passage, right?
Oh, totally.
Like right in the heart of the book, comes after all the household codes of like, this is our ethic.
Mm-hmm.
And if you live out this ethic, you're going to invite questions. So what would you say to someone like, when we think about evangelism, what would evangelism look like if this is a primary text of it for us?
Well, I think that the center of the text is manner, but it assumes that there is this hope in who Jesus is and how that animates our lives, that hope is incredibly distinguishable in the world as a different thing. Like it might create, I mean, in this passage, it's probably they're going to court for this. It's what most scholars think, but it invites a lot of questions. Some of them good, some of them out of humility and curiosity, some of them out of like, how are you saying this,
mm-hmm.
And I think, again, the passage doesn't say, be prepared to give a defense of of your worldview,
mm-hmm.
but of a hope.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have trained, and I'm not against people understanding a worldview that is oriented towards oriented from the scriptures. But I don't like the biblical worldview because that feels audacious and lacking humility. But I do like a biblical worldview.
Yeah.
It's like, this is my best understanding of things. But so I'm not anti-worldview per se. But it sure seems like this passage orients towards a hope that is a disruptive hope.
Yeah.
It can be disruptive. Yeah. It will ultimately, probably at some point, just because of the fallenness of the world,
yeah.
Disrupt the ethic of, in this case, the Roman Empire, but are all the empires we've been talking about the entire time.
Yeah.
And so I have an example where I'm going to try to make the names or make the references a little
oblique.
No, that's not the right word. But anyway, there's a guy who ended up being like the senior right-hand person of a major bank in our region. And one of the first times, there's like sitting across the room from each other, and the head of that bank told his like lieutenant, tell the person that I'm out. And he's like, but you're not out. And he said, just tell them that I'm out. And like, obviously the other person's on hold. And he says, I will tell them that you're not available right now, but I will not tell them that you're not here. Huh. And here's what I promise you. I will never lie to you, and I will never lie for you. Hmm. And this is like, I mean, the guy had just gotten a job at like Muckety Muck Bank, and you know that's a huge risk.
Yeah.
But it's also living out an ethic.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of way of being, now I will name this because it's more generic. Bank of America created its deal that you could do like 2 hours of your 40 hours in helping the poor. Like you could go to a food bank or something like that. I thought that was really great. And at the same time, I was like, well, can you talk about the predatory lenders that you fund?
Yeah.
Like, I'd rather you spend those 2 hours that way to at least try to create some ethic for the good of neighbor that isn't just, you know, there's nothing wrong with putting food on a tray. That's beautiful and glorious. But what, there are other systemic things that you have the power to, in your spheres of influence, to, you're not going to be able to like change an entire banking structure, but you're able to like have conversations.
Right.
I'd rather spend your 2 hours thinking about how the best way to do that is than just going out to the food kitchen or bank or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a way of being that creates us hope, that gets us in some trouble sometimes, but it's so embodying of the ethic of the kingdom and the reign of Jesus that creates questions.
Yeah.
Sorry, long answer.
Okay, so when I talked about this in my college ministry, this verse, mm-hmm. as a way, because, you know, if you do crew or you do Baptist ministry on campus, typically what's involved in those two ministries is going out on campus and sharing your faith.
Okay.
It was part of the discipleship program,
right,
of my campus ministry, that we would go out together. I would watch my campus minister share his faith, and then eventually I would be the one sharing my faith.
Right.
And again, I'm not necessarily poo-pooing that as an idea.
Right.
But I remember having this conversation with my campus minister, and he goes, well, I don't really ever have anyone ask me.
Oh.
Other than doing this. When I do go out on campus and share my faith, then they're asking me, why are you doing this?
Right.
I think there's two different things.
Yeah.
In Peter's imagination. So have you ever had anyone ask you for the reason of the hope that you have? And I'm putting you on the spot. Yeah, I know. Yeah. So I want to say that.
They certainly weren't quoting Peter when they asked me that kind of question. Yeah, yeah. But I do think people are like, this is an odd way of orienting towards, I mean, it could be some political thing, or it could be some way of how a group might be like turning on another person in the group. I'm thinking about my friends who are not necessarily Christian, and Christian for that matter. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, we could do it this way. You know, we could like ask some questions or things like that. So I do think people are like, I mean, it happened on Halloween. I'm sitting at Halloween, mostly non-Christians in the thing, or I know some, don't know some. There's a lot of people there. So, but one, professed atheist. And I said, well, Halloween's the most Christian holiday, that we have, because we give grace when people are trying to scare us. And I mean, she was like, this is awesome. You know what I mean? So that's not asking what the hope is for within me, but it's like your presence there is like, there's a script out there and you're like, well, the gospel script's different. So you just talk about the gospel script in a way that that makes people curious about it. So,
I think the press point. One, it isn't really about our morality in the sense of often how we think about morality. So you're at a party and you don't drink, or you're out at the golf course and you don't cuss. Certainly that can inspire curiosity.
Right.
But in Peter's world, that is not how he's invoking the curious question. The curious question should come because, as you said in your sermon, we, instead of revile, we bless.
Yeah.
That's the primary.
Yeah, that's the main theme. Yeah, yeah.
But it's also then predicated by all the things, the manner that you talked about. And, he, you know, Giorgio built this sermon around these two M words, manner and mission. The first half of the text deals with the manner in which we live. And because there is this humility, which is, you can ground all of those things, not into humility, but humility has to be around all of those things,
yes.
Right? So that because of our humility, we will be these people then that bless instead of revile. And of course, that humility comes from Jesus.
Right.
Right. It's both our union with Jesus and the humbleness of our Savior.
Right.
And it is the life of the Spirit lived out in you, that you are getting into the, you said, good trouble, not trouble for being a jerk.
Right. Or that, trouble for being in trouble. Like, yeah, because we have that too. No, the goodness is the thing that might get you in trouble sometimes.
Right. And so that is what inspires the curiosity for the churches and the people of Peter's world. Remember, they're getting persecuted. And because of their persecution, they are, instead of like walling themselves off, trying to fight, just pretending to be a part of the culture while practicing their faith in private over here, they're not doing any of those things. They're actually living into their persecution by blessing those that are persecuting them.
Right. It's so radical.
It is radical, right? And maybe like part of the struggle that we have in a more Christianized society is that we're not quite to that point to have to invoke that, at least maybe here. I'm sure other parts of the United States,
right,
that may happen more frequently if you live in Seattle or a more like overtly pagan kind of society. I mean, I don't want to say that too harshly.
Yeah.
Where you might experience this a little bit
there's
more.
There's an anti-Christian bias in certain cultures in a country.
Yeah. And that you respond instead of those other ways, walling off, going to war, assimilating. You do respond with a soft difference, and you bless instead of return reviling with reviling, that there might be a curiosity that happens. But I kind of want to like stay here just for a second. Right. So I want to invoke the Big Kahuna. Have you seen the Big Kahuna? I think I have a point here.
Okay. I'm all in.
All right. So Big Kahuna is a movie. Mm-hmm. Kevin Spacey, Danny DeVito. And I don't know this other actor's name. I just know that he was in Twilight later on.
Okay.
He is the actor that plays one of the main vampires in Twilight, like the dad vampire, I think.
Got it.
His name in the show, he is known as Baptist Bob.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
So they're all salesmen, right? And they're locked up in this like hotel room for a conference where they're presenting, I think it's shower curtain rings is what they're selling, but I can't remember.
So awesome.
But they're selling a good, right?
Right.
And they all want this meeting. They're working together for this company and they want this meeting with the Big Kahuna. And the Big Kahuna represents like their meal ticket,
right?
As salesman for the year, like bonuses and all this stuff, right? And so it's a great, it's an interesting movie just because it's kind of set only in this hotel room for the most part, like, and it's a big dialogue movie, like 12 Angry Men, like just all centers around the dialogue,
right.
Largely between Spacey and DeVito, but also Spacey and DeVito and Baptist Bob. Well, Baptist Bob gets the meeting with the Big Kahuna, right? And his job is to sell the shower curtain rings. Like, to do his job well would be, I'm going to, like, meet with Big Kahuna, I'm going to do the salesman. But Bob has a higher purpose, And that purpose is to share the gospel with the big kahuna. And so the conflict in the narrative revolves in part around these two old grizzled salesmen and Baptist Bob and his reluctance to sell the shower curtains and do his job and his insistence on sharing the gospel with the big kahuna. And that's kind of how the story and the conflict envelops. But the how this pertains to what we're talking about today, I think, is that what would be a better way for Bob to spend his time, according to 1 Peter?
That's great. Be a great teammate.
Correct.
Humbly giving up his own gain for the sake of another. Like, I really like to bring my other guys in here.
Which, in the context of this, right, is those other two guys, yeah. Even if they're terrible human beings, which they kind of are portrayed in the show as such.
Right. It's your clear sense of calling. I remember talking to a doctor one time who was like, well, if I ask, I can share the gospel with my patient. I'm like, that's cool. Did you fix their arm?
Yeah.
Your job is to fix their arm.
Right.
You invite them to church. It's my job to preach the gospel. It's not that it's not your job, it's not your job to preach the gospel, but you have one clear calling. Mm-hmm. And do you value that calling mm-hmm. as a work of the Lord? Because I do.
Right.
I don't want, I mean, this happens all the time in different service areas or whatever, where I'm the recipient of someone who wants to talk to me about the gospel. And I'm like, dude, can you just like do my taxes or whatever? That's not the case for my tax person. But Amanda's dad used to, was a general contractor for a long time. And he was like, if they have a fish on their card, I kind of now feel like, and he's a deacon in the Baptist church. So, but if I have a, they have a fish on their card, I'm like, gosh, I just don't know they do the work. They don't, they're not craftsmen, mm-hmm. you know? And I want you to be a craftsman mm-hmm. And see the glory of God in that work, which is what the Reformation has brought to Christianity in a really beautiful way. Mm-hmm. The resurrection of that, it existed before then. But yeah, I think do a good job, make a good shoe and sell it at a fair price is like your calling.
This is what Martin Luther says.
Martin Luther. Yeah, yeah. And I think that's a really beautiful thing that needs to be resurrected in our work. And then not just a good shoe,
yeah.
And definitely a fair price.
Yeah.
And then at some points they're like, the price gouging, you have to say something about.
Yeah.
If you're in that sphere, or the means of production, or the way in which, a Pakistani kid's making a leather soccer ball, and then you're jacking up the price a zillion. Like, how do we get people paid along the way? You know, right. The Mars Company has done a really good job with really trying to figure out this, and I only know this through Lisa Slayton because she was working as a consultant with them at some point, and. They're just like trying to be creative of like, it's a seasonal stuff for like their coffee beans and their chocolate, you know, and they're like, well, how do we get the other people? How do we get our people to work the next 3 months? How can we train them so they have a full life and we're not just, I'm like, that's incredible.
Yeah.
Just to even the question is beautiful.
Yeah.
And it was born out of a deep sense of human dignity and the person who brought this up. Personal faith. Mm-hmm. I'm like, there's so many great ways to do this and do this well that isn't, having to be explicit at every point. You should always be ready. And we as pastors need to help our people be able to say, to not be afraid of telling people about Jesus. Like, I am for that 100%. But at the same time, faithfulness, humility, not reviling when your boss is a jerk, like that bears witness.
So you said in the sermon, like you asked the congregation at one point, what are you zealous about? Which I thought was an important question, and I'm coming out of the text, and it relates to this conversation. Mm-hmm. So when we think about Baptist Bob, okay, what is he? This is the tension point. So the tension point, I think, rests in, are we being asked, and why are we being asked?
Right.
What are we inspiring the curiosity to be asked this question for the hope that we have? So does our hope and the way that hope animate us cause there to be a curiosity in the world that someone might ask us, what's the reason for the hope that you have, right?
Right.
When we say, what are we zealous about? I think it relates to vocational questions. Baptist Bob, we're not really given in the movie, like the interior dialogue of what he's actually zealous about. So we have to assume at one level, best case scenario, giving him the best benefit of the doubt, that he's zealous for Jesus,
yeah.
Right? And so he feels like because he's zealous for Jesus, he has to share the gospel with the big kahuna versus make his sale and do his job, right?
Right.
Back to your doctor point. A doctor who prays for a patient can be something that's very encouraging.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can be off-putting to somebody as well. It can be something that like, man, it does somehow like give reason to the hope that he has in the sense of like, I'm a skilled doctor, but I need God's help
right.
to do this well, right? There's all sorts of things that can portray. And so you might come into a hospital room, you might be a non-Christian, and the doctor asks to pray for you, and you're like, man, I'm open to that because I'm here
yeah,
on
I'm
this
good.
Table.
I'm about to get cut.
Right? But there is a sense in which if that doctor does his job really well, and that is more than just the surgery, right? So the doctor has a bedside manner.
Yeah.
He's empathetic and understanding. He tries to listen very well, like as a good doctor would. Like, he doesn't try to, like, you know, just make quick decisions,
right.
move through the office really fast. Right. It's all these things.
Right.
That if you do all those elements of your job and that you had an experience with that doctor that you hadn't had with any other doctor before,
right.
where you might say to that doctor, man, like, you're such a good doctor. Like, what made you that way?
Now you can talk.
And now you can talk.
Now you can, it's going to be
so
great.
For Bob, right? Like, what if Bob took a different approach and he was like, I'm just going to drive home to the big kahuna. Why are, and again, we're talking about sales and like, this is not like,
okay.
It's not, you know, shower curtain rings, not the greatest good
to humanity.
I mean, it's a perfect
example of that. Yeah, right. It's just like,
it provides a utilitarian, like very like, yes, we need shower curtain rings if we're going to hang up our shower curtains.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's what he's selling. I don't totally remember, but
right.
Like Bob's job is to then like be a good salesman.
That's right.
What would a good salesman look like in that situation?
No lies, no selling beyond what you can deal, making sure that you know that it's stocked.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, like, this is my wife's in the design business, and like sometimes she's at some warehouse and they're like, yeah, we can get these. And then and she's thinking in the 4 weeks you just told me they were in, but it's not necessarily going to be that way. So there's no deception. There's no lies. You say things, and this happens a lot. Like, I don't know if this product, even the person selling two different products, I'm like, this product, you need to know you're buying a cheaper product and it's going to last X amount of years. If you buy this more expensive product, it's going to be 2X years.
Right.
But you give that person, like, it's just that kind of clarity.
And in this, and in the movie setting, it is understanding that he is a meal ticket for his two fellow salespeople. Like, it's not just Bob who's earning the commission.
Right. It's they.
Now, again, I could be messing up the movie. So if you're a big kahuna fan out there and you really know this movie, but at least in my recollection, there is a sense in which if Bob gets the bonus, they all win.
Yeah. The team wins.
And Bob's jeopardizing that.
Right.
And maybe in the movie he's jeopardizing that because they don't get the meeting with the big kahuna and he does. I don't remember. And they're mad about that. That could be very possible. The thing I haven't seen in a long time. But either way, like if Bob is called to do this job, there would be a way for him to inspire curiosity that could lead to the sharing of the hope that he has and the gospel.
Absolutely. There's always that option.
And so like I want like to bring this back to your sermon, like, what are we zealous for?
Right.
The glory of God and the good of neighbor. So you really like kind of hit that at several different points
right.
in the sermon that like we want God to glory. And I don't think that's the term you might have used.
No, I said glory of God and good of neighbor.
But that's what
mission and manner and glory of God.
This is what Peter's calling this church to be animated by, to be zealous for.
That's right.
And if we are zealous for that, then Jesus becomes the pattern,
right,
by which we live that out, right? Jesus lived for God's glory all the way to the cross.
Right.
He lived for our good by dying on that cross. Mm-hmm. And that kenosis and emptying of himself, and we just read this book by Wolf, but he talks about in Greco-Roman society, the four descents of Jesus in Philippians 2. Mm. Like, he did not consider equality with God something to be grasped after, right, latched onto, pursued, exploited.
Right.
Like, he has this identity with the King.
Right.
And he doesn't exploit that, which, right, we all know this. Like, I don't know if you've ever done this, but you know somebody,
right,
you name drop,
yeah,
like you're exploiting your relationship with somebody,
absolutely,
right? Right?
Yeah.
He didn't just do that. Then he became a human. So he dropped his class, his status,
right,
not just one level, but two. He became, right, a slave.
Right.
And he died
to death on a cross.
The, right, right, most cursed, blasphemous death that you could die as a Roman citizen.
Right.
So he descends in four ways. So that's our pattern,
right?
Right, for God's glory and our neighbor's good. Like, there is no other pattern,
no,
offered to us.
That's why I said it's excruciating. It's just not complicated,
right? Right.
It's simple. It just kind of stinks.
Yeah. And so, like, that is, I think, what Peter wants us to be zealous for. Now, it comes from we've been born into this living hope,
right? Right.
So right. it's almost like because of our union and relationship with Jesus, our love for him, out of that place comes this, and you use the word, the guts, mm-hmm, which I loved. Right. Like, I forget the exact phrase. I'm going to pull it up here on my notes. You said...
was it kind bowled?
Yeah, kind bowled. And I really latched onto that, especially in the second sermon. Like, there is this something in our guts,
right,
that is that's transformed, and out of our gut we exude this, like, kindness,
right,
this brotherly love, this unity that comes from the deepest parts of our, like, being, yeah, and from that place we are animated,
right,
differently. We, right, are orientated. I think you are orientated to the, mm-hmm, world differently. And it's our manner and our mission. They're married together. And that gutter response is like, this is how we are.
Yeah, manner and mission are the same. Like, manner is mission. Mission is manner. It's like the same thing because it's in your person. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I mean, to continue on Philippians, and this is where the hope comes in, is that, and then God raised him from the dead, and every knee shall bow to the glory of Jesus. Like, he resurrects him. Mm-hmm. We're not in control of that. Mm-hmm. And so that's our hope, is that God's going to do something amazing. The Spirit's going to move in some wild way that we're like, oh, this is the power of God working through the manner of Jesus.
Right. And here's what Wolf would add to that.
Yeah.
Like, in his book, he would say, that actual path that Jesus goes down,
mm-hmm,
is the thing, not the vindication. Because he's kind of trying to make, and this is getting off far field.
All right.
Nobody else has read this book. You haven't read this book. But I think it's pertinent to the conversation,
yeah,
in that, like, sometimes we can go, we're going to be vindicated, so I'll go down
because, oh, yeah,
eventually I'm going to be brought back up. And so he's kind of dealing with this idea of superiority.
Yeah.
How do we, like... Right.
Who can go humble enough?
Yeah, who can compare us?
We're super comparing humble.
Our tendencies to compare ourselves to others.
That's
and
right.
Then to be superior to others. We can do that in a lot of ways by making them more and more inferior. We may be inferior at start, but we can make them lower and lower and lower, mm-hmm, until we somehow raise above them.
Yeah, I totally
Or we can just pursue raising above them. And so he's like... Do you just
hilarious.
Do good so you'll be raised up?
Right.
And that's, he's trying to make the argument. No, it's the actual descent,
yeah,
that's the glory of God. Like, the glory of God is that God took this descent. And then the glory of God for us is that we get to take the descent.
Right, right.
Yes, there is a hope that we will be raised up.
Right.
Which may be the reason for the hope that we have.
Right, right.
But we aren't like doing it just to be raised.
Right, right.
Up,
you're not going to do it well enough to get raised up.
Right, right. Just right, to somehow be superior.
Right, 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 right.
Or that the Christian message would be superior.
Right, right, right.
Which is like kind of how we enter into evangelism most times.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like when we go out to share our faith, we're arguing against someone else's belief system and we're showing them how Christianity is
superior.
Superior.
Prove me wrong.
Right. Where Peter's almost saying, no, like you're going to go ahead and keep identifying with the low place.
Right.
And you're going to bless out of that low place.
That's right. You're going to do the good.
Do the good, from the low place. When you have no status.
Right.
When you are being persecuted. When you are being maligned. So it's hard to translate this in some ways individually in our cultural moment.
Right.
Individually.
Right.
Like, but when we peel the curtain back a little bit bigger to a more meta view, it's a little bit easier.
Right, right.
Because of what we're involved in right now.
Right. This is where why I started off with the church in the West has a PR problem. But it's not because we need better PR, which we do, but because we don't live like this.
Right.
And we have not abided by these words.
Okay, so why? Why won't we live like this? Why is it so tempting
to because not we're live zealous this way? For our comfort. Mm. We're zealous for the American dream. We are zealous. I'm including myself in this. Don't please.
Yeah.
This is my own brokenness. It's my zealous to be right. Mm. I'm zealous for ease and the good life that is so tempting in our world. Mm. And we all have different degrees of what the good life would be, but it's still real. I mean, over the years I've been an adult, my good life ambitions have increased.
Correct.
I remember.
It's funny how that happens.
No, and you're like, oh, well, that's the good life. I didn't know about that. Mm. And you know, this is like, you know, the was it Ted Turner? It was Carnegie was asked, you know, when do you know when you've made enough money? He goes, or when will it be enough? He goes, just a little bit more.
A little bit more.
A little bit more.
Don Draper.
Don
that
Draper.
That moment you get happiness. You just want to get a little more happiness.
Yeah. It's in that we just need to realize that that's demonic and it's real and we all struggle with it and we can have humility towards that and our neighbors in it.
Yeah.
And compassion and show repentance and how Jesus is liberating us from that. And it's not like we do it perfectly. We just need a little bit more repentance, a little bit more downward mobility, a little bit more ways of walking in his steps, Peter phrase. And in his steps, they're stepping downward. And again, excruciating.
This is where the drive for status and the drive, this is why I think I have a book club and we read this Miroslav book, which is The Cost of Ambition. When I picked that book up, I thought he was talking about just ambition kind of general. Mm-hmm. What I realized, and it's in the title on the front of the book, I shouldn't have known, but I'm not a details guy, but that it's the quest for being superior that comes with ambition, right? And why it really identified with me, I think, because I'm in First Peter and I'm thinking about status and to the question of like why we don't do this is because we all want to have status. It is why we name drop, and I'm as guilty as anybody with name drop. I just dropped Wolf on you and read his book. Like, we're guilty of name dropping and achieving status in that way and comparing ourselves with our neighbor and elevating our status. And so, and we're the water that we swim in that we don't know is water is about status, elevating, finding status. Obviously, our moment has added to that with all sorts of trinkets to help increase our status.
Right.
And so I think the temptation for us as Christians in the West is to somehow improve it's to do the PR work, like you said,
right?
Increase our status,
right?
And it doesn't matter however we do that,
right? The manner of that is, you know, it's just so difficult.
Like, even purity culture,
it's a status culture,
oh, man, right?
You can go online and watch,
got your purity ring, and you made it to the wedding bed, and you're a virgin, and like, that's a status marker in that own little
sphere of our world.
Yeah, right?
Absolutely. I am more reformed than you. I am
correct.
More freed from the opinions of men than you. You shouldn't be a. We want to be freed from the opinions of men, but then it becomes this badge of honor that is just not the point.
Right. So even when we go out on campus to share our faith, in some sense, we're doing that for status. And when we're persecuted for that very work, it's for status that we increase our status by being persecuted. And I think it's reading the New Testament wrong.
Absolutely.
But it's so embedded in all of what we kind of got in the church.
Oh, yeah.
And instead, no, it really is the path downward that we are on. We are on this path downward. And yet, from the downward place, not to achieve status or raise ourselves back up to the top or create a subsystem of status making in the bottom level.
Right.
On the bottom floor, in the basement. Like, I live in the basement.
I'm the mayor of the island.
But my basement is a man cave, dog. Like,
mayor of island of the island of Misfit Toys.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. And no, but we're okay being in the low place because that's where Jesus is.
Right. And I think there is also kind of the, I just read a book on missionary children and there, she was writing, and she went she was in Nairobi, which is a pretty big city, you know, whatever. But the status of the kids that grew up on the bush, where it was like the higher status, you know, and don't even talk to them about the missionary kids that were in like the Czech Republic. I mean, they have running water and those guys are sellouts. And so I think there's a reverse of what you're talking about is like, where's the status is hit. Because what we also want is if the Lord has given you these incredible gifts that may make you a lot of money or help you perform in incredible ways. It's not that you should be ashamed of that.
Right.
You should, but then you have your head on a swivel of like, how can I help others? What else is going, how is this doing good?
Yeah.
And you get your good-o-meter out.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, let me test this because now I've reached some level of success in the world. And I'm like, okay, so now what can I do? How do I make that work?
Yeah, it comes back to the Baptist Bob idea of like, this is your vocational impulse.
Right, right.
Like your vocational impulse in these moments because of either the work that you did that you were blessed in that work and you achieved some status.
Right, right.
You're recognizing whatever status I achieved was given to me by God.
Yeah, that's right. And so now I
have
give it
no
away.
Status that I achieved on my own.
That's right.
And so from that vocational impulse, I can give of myself and
absolutely.
Give of my resources away.
Right.
And certainly there's a certain wisdom and strategy that comes with that.
Right.
It's not just like carte blanche, unregarded. However, I think about Keller and Generous Justice, where he's like sometimes it is right just to give cash to somebody on the street
right.
and not worry about what they're going to do with that money. Like it is an act of generous justice to do that. That may not be the carte blanche way of doing it all the time, but sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
But you are also using wisdom and strategy in that process. I thought one of the, you had a couple different metaphors. I love, the head on the swivel metaphor is like dear to my heart because this is a family motto in my family.
I know. I love
it. Like whenever my kids go out, like I tell them, keep your head on a swivel.
Yeah.
And whenever my boys got in a game or my daughter got in a game, I would say keep your head on a swivel.
Absolutely.
Like you have
actually that came to me in my family when Carver was like in second grade and he was playing goalie and his coach said, keep your head on a swivel. And I was like, I love this so much.
Yeah.
This is so
And in the church, that really is our calling. Like if we are gonna be a people of welcome and making room, we have to have our head on a swivel to do that. We have to see. And that connects, you said this at one point in the sermon, Wolf talked about it, I talked about it in the sermon the last couple of weeks, is that we have to be able to see the other.
Yeah.
Like, and the only thing that helps us to see the other clearly is all the manner things
right.
that you presented. Like those things are the things that clear the slug out of our eyes.
Right. The judginess.
We can have the humility of sight. Right. I think this also connects really well with our justification. Like you talked about reformed people. You kind of took a little dig at reformed people. And this is true if you are reformed and you're listening to this, you became a Calvinist, you existed in some form or fashion, cage stage Calvinism, which is what we call someone who just learned about Calvinism and has to tell everybody about their Calvinism and takes pride in the fact that they now understand Calvinism. And that is the very, that is anathema to the idea of Calvinism.
Right, absolutely.
Right? So like if God is this God who out of whatever his divine foreknowledge elects, of no intent on the person he's electing, like it's, he didn't elect Giorgio because he knew Giorgio was going to become this pastor who has this amazing story of being redeemed and that he would then be able to share that story. And that's why he elected Giorgio. No, it's like that has irregardless of God's election, it's unconditional. And like God found you, rescued you of nothing of your own.
Right.
Our justification is by faith. It's not our own faith.
Right.
It's faith that's a gift.
Right. Through the grace that is unearned.
The grace is unearned merit, right? Yeah. So there's no meriting in the gospel. And so that should, by its very nature, make us the most humble of people.
Like, I don't know why I did it.
I don't know. Tell us, blind man. I don't know. I just know that I was blind and now I see.
Right.
And I can't tell you anything other than that.
That's right. That's some evangelism
That's evangelism, right? That's like the hope that we have comes from that place. And that enables us to be people who go low.
Right.
And to lose status. And to embrace our vocations fully from this place of not earning.
Right.
Simply a calling of glory in God and good of neighbor. Yeah. Meeting them with our gladness and their deep wounds.
That's right.
And that is how we can like enact this hope, this curiosity about the hope that we have.
Yeah. And if you're at a status level where you're not finding any good you can do, go down.
Go down.
You'll find some more.
Yeah. And that
I think that's like, it's,
and that's true.
Real like, simple.
The people, if you've ever been in a place where status has been stripped away and you've had the fortunate experience of being in those places, you look around and you, man, these people are so happy and that yet they're suffering so much.
Right.
How can that be? There's this curiosity.
Yeah.
Because their status has been stripped. And this is who Peter's talking to.
Yes.
Peter's talking to believers who have had their status taken away, that they had, whatever they had in the Greco-Roman world is being taken. And from that place, he calls them to bless.
Yeah. It's incredible. I mean, it's truly, I think it's so like, I mean, really, since seminary, working through this passage and some of the diaconal passages or diakonos, which is servant, this has been a life's study. And I don't mean that just in terms of the scriptures, which it is also included, but what does it mean? I mean, I'm not, I planted a church in Charlotte and then I realized I shouldn't be the senior pastor.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're a good example to us.
But I don't want to toot your horn. Wrestling through that. I was just wrestling through that. I was like, oh, I think this is the way to bless the folks and I'll be all right.
Yeah.
Because Jesus is with me.
Yeah.
It wasn't even that noble. It was like a no duh moment. You know what I mean? Like, I was just like, oh, yeah, this one makes sense. Yeah. So I just think it's this is why I always say, like, have some area in your life where you're with the poor, the marginalized. You'll be able to be a blessing, but you're going to be like, I can see Jesus around these parts. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You're like, and show up, hang out, see what happens.
Yeah. Like, you used another metaphor, of the huddle, which I thought was really great. Like you said, Peter calls him into a huddle and he explains this is the manner in which we're going to live. And then he says, break. And then they go out to do the mission and they get like sacked. Right. And he calls them back to the huddle, calls timeout, and like, okay, this is still our manner. Nothing's changed. And we're still going to run this play. And you go out and run the play and you get sacked again. And he goes, we're not changing it. We're going to keep running this play. And I think that that really does get at the heart of what Peter's saying throughout the book, is that soft difference is keeping running this play.
Yeah.
We're not changing it to win.
We're not changing it because we're about the good of neighbor and glory of God.
Right.
That's our winning.
That's our winning. Even if that means we continue to hang out in the low place, that's our winning. All right. The last question, I usually lead with this, but I just kind of want to talk to you about how you put all this together. Like, in the crafting of the sermon, like you talked about in the beginning of the sermon, like when you preached this before, it was three sermons. Right. Now you're preaching it in one. So like, what was the process for you as you kind of crafted this out? What got left out that you wish you would have said?
Yeah, I had a whole thing on Cyprian. I gave a little head nod to Cyprian.
Also, the second sermon was quite a bit different than the first sermon.
Yeah, I did do that.
You pulled an Edgar on that one.
I did pull an Edgar on that one. Also, because Justin said, hey, don't forget that it's actually
All Saints Day.
Yeah. And I was like, and, you know, on Thursday, I was like, oh, yeah, I'll totally do that. And then on Sunday, when we were doing the supper, you brought it in. I was like, oh, I can easily do this and bring it in. So I added a couple more references to the saints that have gone before us in that. But like I had a whole Cyprian thing in there about how they managed to serve and take babies off trash heaps and like the good and the radical good that they did. And they got blamed for spreading the plague.
Right. That's the thing about this, is that you could do good and you get
more
shame on yourself and your family and your.
I remember there was a Raleigh church that was feeding folks in a bunch of folks that were not housed in a park, and they're like, somebody was like, "Well, you don't have a permit for this, and you have not taken it through whatever agricultural deal it is." And I was like, come on, get a Good Samaritan. Yeah. Like, isn't there a Good Samaritan law on this?
Right.
Like, ain't nobody worried about it but you, you know? And so they got in trouble and they have to do that stuff. Now, for something like Second Harvest, I want them to have all that because it's such a mass amount of people. Mm. But you know, this is a church trying to feed some people. It's like putting peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and, like, you know, hot dogs and, you know, just give them something to eat.
Right.
So you can get yourself in all sorts of trouble for such things. But yeah, I think I had a whole bunch of like one of the first sermons I did was about like kind of using Cyprian as the main metaphor, as the main story through it all. The other one was like, I just did one on that first verse, which was just this humility, this way of being in the world is what leads us into our mission. And then I do think that the thing that came to me that helped me bring it together was the huddle, because I had those three things. And so I did have like, here, huddle up. And then I had a timeout. We got to explore it a little bit more. And then we're going to run the play. And then we're going to run the play. And then we're going to run the play. And so that, for some reason, that hit, probably because I was watching football. But I was like, okay, this is it.
Yeah, that's
good. And so that, usually for me, that's like, now I understand the structure.
Yeah.
And how those things connected. Because he quotes Psalm 34 in there, and I was like, oh, that's the playbook.
Yeah.
You know, it just was like clink, 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 clink. And I was like, okay, I know what to do now. And then I ended, I did not say this on purpose, but I ended in the sermon on a quote from a pastor from the civil rights. It is Dr. King.
Yeah.
But I didn't want anybody to be like, oh, well, he was also had some issues. I was like, yes, he had some issues. Like,
we all do.
David and everyone else. Yeah. But the beauty of those words of, you can do whatever you want to us, we're going to love you.
Yeah.
I choose love. Like, this is where we go. Same play over and over again. No matter what you bring our way, we're going to love you.
Yeah.
I mean, that's some radical, awesome stuff. Yeah. So this is what the church needs in the West.
Yeah, it does.
Because we have totally been syncretized to the ways of the world and its toxicity and meanness and cruelty. We got a lot of work to do.
Remember what Peter's building on is that you are living stones, Redeemer. Like, called to be the house of God. And out of that place, then you seek to do good to the outsider. And on the inside, you honor those who are below you with less status. You seek to elevate them while you go down.
That's right.
And in doing that, you're running the play.
Right.
And in running the play, the hope is people will be curious.
Right.
Not because we're odd in the way we dress or talk or even behave, as other than our behavior, the holy thing, remember, being holy for Peter is how do you love God and neighbor?
That's right.
And that is what is intended to spark the curiosity about your hope. So wherever you're at today, you know, as you think about being a witness, strive to live a life of curiosity that might look like going to the low place.
Amen.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank
you guys. Good job on the sermon there.
Thanks, bro.
G, appreciate you. We'll see you next time.